Welcome back to the Bob Davis Podcast. This is Podcast 397, The New Talk. I want to talk about the news cycle and polling. Been watching the news cycle this week and last week, and I'm amazed at the reaction of two stories in this country. One, of course, is Cecil the Lion. We now have a name for the lion, Cecil the Lion, and of course, Donald Trump. And we're going to talk about both of these stories in Podcast 397, The New Talk, the Bob Davis Podcasts. So, yeah, I'm sitting out here on the deck, and I just had a great conversation with a guy that owns the house that I rent. We were talking about toilets and plumbing and things of that nature and fixing things, and I had to remind him about Ryan Plumbing and Heating. And here, I'm just going to focus on one thing. I talk a lot about Ryan Plumbing and Heating. Ryan is one of the long-term sponsors of the Bob Davis Podcast. I want to talk about emergency service. Ryan is great at emergency service. So whatever your problem, a lot of times when something happens, a pipe breaks or a toilet breaks, it doesn't work, and you're in a bind, you don't know who to call. You're like, well, what plumber do I call? Call Ryan Plumbing and Heating. First of all, they've been in business for generations over there on University Avenue in St. Paul by the Capitol. Secondly, they go metro-wide, so they're all over Mendota and, you know, East St. Paul and South St. Paul and Plymouth, and you'll see their trucks everywhere, and they're great at emergency service. So in St. Paul, if you want to call Ryan, you call 651-224-4771. In Minneapolis, you can call 627-927-6488. They come out metro-wide from St. Paul, and that, of course, as I said, means the suburbs too. Four generations of quality replacement and repair of all plumbing, heating, and air conditioning systems. Now, when I talk about toilets breaking or I talk about emergency service, a lot of people think residential, but it's also true for business. And sometimes when you're in business, something happens, you don't know what to do either, and you got to get it done. And you've got to get it done according to the rules. And of course, Ryan does a lot of contract stuff, so they deal with a lot of big businesses as well, and they deal with a lot of business contracting, so they're great for that too. Ryan Plumbing and Heating on University Avenue in St. Paul, just west of the state capitol, where they've always been. If you have an emergency, think Ryan Plumbing and Heating, 651-224-4771 in St. Paul. In Minneapolis, 612-927-6488. Ryan Plumbing and Heating, and thanks, Greg Ryan, for sponsoring the Bob Davis Podcasts. Well, let me start by saying I'm live from the deck tonight. And I love to be live from the deck because it's Tiki Torch podcasting. I have two huge Tiki Torches, which are shedding light. So it's literally like being by the side of the fire, and I love that. And I'm using I use a different mic setup for almost every single podcast I do, whether it's in the mobile podcast command unit, or it's down on the flat, or it's up here on the deck. And this mic that I'm using is really sensitive to all kinds of things. So if I put my feet in a certain place, or if I move the chair too much, you can hear it. But I've set it up so I can just kind of relax and drink my coffee and talk about this particular topic, this news cycle and polling topic, and I'm a little frustrated right now. So I want you to start by thinking back to August. I think it was August. I know it was August of 2001. Do you remember what the lead stories were in August of 2001? Talk radio, the 24-hour cable news channels, all the commentators were occupied by a murder in Washington, D.C. of an intern for California Congressman Gary Condit, Chandra Levy. Levy and Condit, it was reported and emerged during the murder investigation, were indeed having an affair. And of course, the big fight was whether or not Gary Condit was implicit in the murder of Chandra Levy. Nobody has ever figured out what happened to her. The murder of Levy continues to be one of the most famous unsolved crimes in Washington, D.C. Gary Condit later had to resign, and I don't know what happened to him. But you couldn't get away from that story in August of 2001, and now people can't even remember Gary Condit's name. Why? Well, something happened, and that something was 9/11. A few minutes ago, a few months ago, a few hours ago, a few days ago, a few weeks ago, the 24-hour news channel, Drudge, all the internet news websites, the bloggers, everybody had an opinion on what had happened to the Malaysian Air Flight, I think it was MH370. You couldn't get away from that story either. And of course, who can forget? I certainly can't. Who could forget Ebola? That was a huge story. All these stories eventually ended unresolved. MH370 is still missing, and they think they may have found it, which caused CNN to break in today. CNN has made the MH370 story the centerpiece of their network. I don't know why, but if a gnat flies someplace and it has something to do with that plane, they will break in. But they found some wreckage recently, and they think it might be that plane. We don't know if it is or it isn't, but that doesn't mean that we aren't going to break in and cover it 24 hours a day, which drives me crazy. And of course, Ebola is still raging in Africa, apparently unaddressed in, well, not all of Africa, but parts of Africa. In fact, there was a story about it today. So these experiences should teach us something about the news cycle on a little bit smaller scale. If you're paying attention and you don't get too caught up in the day-to-day, you realize that these stories come, they take over the headlines and the news channels, and they are the topic of conversation, and eventually they aren't resolved so much as they just go away. They're pushed out of the headlines and our consciousness by another more lurid headline, and then we're on to another story. And this is how it's going to be with the story of poor Cecil the Lion, who has maintained, or no, I shouldn't say maintained, but attained the status of a human being, killed legally or not by the Minnesota dentist, it had to be a Minnesota dentist, of course, who is currently the victim of a media and internet lynching, regardless of what he did or didn't do, whether it was legal or not, in Zimbabwe, complete with media trucks outside his house and protesters in Eden Prairie, Minnesota, for this. In the grand scheme of things, is Cecil the Lion really worth your time? And I would have to answer the question, while I might feel badly about the hunter, and while I think that, you know, if you're really into hunting, you probably, you know, don't necessarily, you shouldn't feel great about having an animal lured out right in front of you. But without getting into too many details, if you never knew about Cecil the Lion in the first place, does his death at the hands of an allegedly overzealous bow hunter really matter? And I would have to say, to me, no. What the Cecil story did was push the Planned Parenthood expose off the front pages. But don't worry, it will be back as well. Each time one of these lurid stories breaks, it catches and takes hold, and then the tribes come out in support or in opposition to whatever the story represents. It takes hold on Twitter and Facebook and all these other social media websites, and it runs its course until something else comes along that takes everybody's attention away. And then there is the Donald Trump story. Trump, who long ago learned how to poke the bear and get publicity, has turned to stirring the political pot with predictable results. Trump, the national celebrity and star of the show. Wait a minute. I don't think I even remember the name of the show. What was it? The Apprentice. I watched it once. I thought it was a good show. Trump, the one-time presidential candidate in 2012, has returned to capture the attention of Republicans again in 2015 and 2016. Now, these days, you're not allowed to criticize Trump, the sudden conservative standard bearer. If you say anything potentially negative about Trump, people block you on Twitter, they yell at you. They say it's all part of the establishment conspiracy to discredit Trump, whatever that is, and generally say that Trump is the one who can win. Just as they said Romney was the one who can win, Trump is now the one who can win, who can make the Republican Party and the country again great. So if you say, well, okay, how do you substantiate that? They say, just look at the polls. Look at the polls, it'll tell you. And then, so this is the thing that's interesting to me about this, and it's what I want to talk about in this podcast. The same people who say, the polls are rigged, I hear this all, the polls are rigged, I don't trust any polls. Or that polls predicted Mitt Romney would be the winner in 2012, now will cite polls to show how strong a Trump candidacy, a Republican or third party candidacy of a Donald Trump, will be. I personally would not even attempt, and I can't predict what is going to happen with Donald Trump. I don't endorse any candidate in this race, Republican or Democrat or independent. I am not going to tell you who to vote for. I'm not even going to tell you what you should be concerned about, because I've learned long ago that that is a joke and it's not helpful at all, because you're just going to have to figure this stuff out for yourself. But I'm going to say this. People are making some wild claims about Donald Trump and about polling online and in the media, and I need to answer some of these statements. And I think it'll help on a lot of levels, and it should be something that you kind of put away and think about re-listening to later on in the political process, because I'm going to talk a little bit about polling. First of all, most people know me as a podcaster. Some other people know me as a talk radio person. But I also was a radio programmer and a radio executive and a research executive, a marketing research executive in radio for many, many years. In fact, I was one of the early market research pathfinders in radio going back to the 1970s. And what I did was call people up and ask them what their favorite songs were and gather information about radio station. And I kind of taught myself market research over the years, making and to the point where when I worked for the company that owned WCCO at the time, so they owned all of the CCOs, the AM, FM, TV, and a bunch of other stations. And I did all the research for them and consulted with those companies. And we had a building in downtown Minneapolis. It's actually still there, 1016 Marquette, which they're going to tear down eventually. But that was my building, and I had 30 or 40 telemarketers who would work back there and make calls, and we fielded thousands and thousands of calls. Actually, we made thousands and thousands of calls, and I was able to predict radio ratings within a tenth of a point. Ask anybody in town, and I'll tell you about that, and did a lot of research for WCCO-TV so forth. And the thing that I learned in radio research is, first of all, there are some similarities in radio research and political research. So this is why I'm able to talk about political research with a little bit of more authority. Now, I'm not saying to everyone I'm a political scientist, and I'm not telling everyone I'm a political market research guy, but I do. It's sort of speaking the same language. It's like Italian and Portuguese, or Spanish and Portuguese. There are similarities in the languages. So what you're doing is you're researching an intangible with radio research and television and media research and political research, because the field is constantly shifting. And the thing that you learn after you do it for a while is you can't take a research report and make a predictable result and say you should do this, because most of the time listening to the radio, watching a TV station, or voting for a particular candidate is hidden. The interest in voting for that person or listening to that station or buying that thing, whatever it is, or watching that TV station has more to do with people's deeper desires, aspirations, and interests than it does with something that they don't care about, like a detergent. Even though market researchers will tell you, especially if you watch Mad Men, this is something that comes through loud and clear, product market research and getting people to buy products generally has to do more with intangibles and aspirations than it has to do with anything else. And there's all kinds of research about that out there that's sociological research. And you'll hear market researchers refer to Maslow, and you'll hear them refer to Jung, and you'll hear them, advertising executives tend to work on these deeper desires. And sometimes the campaign has nothing to do with what the research shows. This was a tough lesson to learn in radio, where radio executives and TV executives tend to be very black and white. They want you to tell them, if I say you're going to get 30% of the audience, then that means you're going to get this much of a share. And then I would also say that TV research is even more like political research, but it's harder to research issues. I used to do surveys to get an idea of what news stories people were interested in, and that was one of the things that was really fascinating. Because when you research issues, you have to define the issue, and once you do that, you're looking at your perception of what an issue is as opposed to what their perception of what an issue is. And so it's impossible to research issues and things like that, especially if they're emotional, without inserting and creating some kind of bias. That does not mean that you're rigging the poll. It means that any way to ask a question is going to produce a certain kind of response. At that time, when I was doing research, it was difficult because you had to do it on the phone, and now it's almost impossible to do it on the phone. Online research systems are not proven. Online tangibles like hits, clicks, and so forth are better data. So I talk a lot about radio ratings versus what we have in the digital media. We know how many feeds. We know where the feeds are going. We know who's taking the feeds. We can do subscribers down to IP addresses. We have tangible geographic data. And when you build year after year after year in terms of raw numbers, that information gets really stable. So the information that digital broadcasters and digital people like me, podcasters, have is better than what we had in radio. But the online research systems are not necessarily proven when it comes to asking questions. And then when you get into comparing tangibles and opinion and things like that, it's hard to say whether the new methods of research are any better than telephone research. And of course, not everybody has a telephone anymore, and people don't answer their cell phones. So it becomes even more difficult. The bottom line with all these intangibles is what people say, what they do, and the difference between the two is really what you're measuring. So this then creates and outlines the problem with political research, because people only vote once. You have an election. You either have a primary election, or you have a statewide election, or you have a national election. And so the political scientists are constantly compiling and comparing data and sifting through election data and election, post-election polls, what do they call them? Polling place polls and things like that. The polling data only shows one side of the picture. You have to compare it to actual voting records to see whether it makes any sense. And when a politician hires a pollster, that's what's going on behind the scenes. The pollster is interfacing with political scientists and campaign managers to talk about people's votes in previous elections, what the polling shows, the differences between the two, and perhaps what they mean. So there's a lot of comparison along those lines, too. When you read about a poll that's been taken by a university or PPP or someone like that, those are polls that are generally done for media consumption to get politicians to buy the poll data, right? So, when it's reported that a poll says this, that, or the other thing, you're not hearing the other channel of communications, which is really comparing voting data from a political scientist point of view and comparing polling data, and politicians that understand the difference between the two and how to supersede what the polls say, which they can do sometimes if they're particularly gifted. And even when you do all of this, the issues that people vote on can change in a blink of an eye. The ground in politics is constantly shifting. It shifts all the time in radio, but really it shifts literally day to day in politics. And it has a lot more to do with what's in the news on a day-to-day basis than anything. And it has a lot to do with the capabilities of individual candidates and the issues they're talking about, how they talk about them, where they talk about them, and what they actually say when they're talking about them. And it also has to do with how gifted a particular politician is. And if you've ever seen politics and politicians up close, sometimes these guys are great on television and they're flat in person and vice versa. And sometimes they're really popular individually and they're able to go out and get people to really like them. And when they're a congressman, that's one thing because they're dealing with a congressional district or a governor. But when they run for a national office, it's a different thing entirely. So whether it's a new restaurant that's rolling out nationwide, an all new redesigned Ford, a household candidate, a survey on a particular advertising campaign, some kind of household product, especially a household product, or a presidential candidate, and especially if it's a political candidate, selling that candidate or selling ideas that will drive that candidate through the big national election if they're running for president. So they have to go through state primaries, they have to go through the convention, and then they have to win the actual election. And really, the election is 50 state races in an electoral college. It's extremely complicated to get a clear picture of what's going on. Now, right now, Donald Trump is riffing on the fact that establishment candidates don't deviate from prepared remarks and they won't address issues head on. And it's been generally conventional wisdom that the best candidates are the ones you can't pull off message. Bush was like that. Clinton was extremely, I'm talking about Bill Clinton, was extremely gifted at staying on message, but straying and handling it. So he was a policy wonk, and he understood what he was doing and how he was doing it. But generally, the best candidates stay on message no matter what. Trump isn't like that, because what's happening with Trump is the other candidates are the story right now. He's just reacting. He's reacting to news events. He's reacting like a talk show host. When he becomes the story and people start reacting to him, it's going to be a different agenda. This is where the famous line from the movie The War Room becomes key. In fact, I would suggest that everybody watch The War Room again, which was about the 1992 presidential campaign, or primary colors for that matter, because they will give you a great background in the fact that what the media gives, the media taketh away, and suddenly and unpredictably. What has Donald Trump specifically proposed going deeper than a rhetorical argument for addressing immigration and the economy, for example? And I'm not saying he has to, and I'm not saying I disagree with him, but I'm asking you, can you be specific about what he actually wants to do? What has he done in his life that makes him a conservative, quote-unquote conservative, or for that matter, a quote-unquote Republican? And while you're at it, what is a conservative? So you would start, and I've talked about this many times, by actually defining what a conservative is anyway. Now, this isn't to attack Trump, as I said, and I'll have to say it again, because people are immediately defensive about this. This is to point out the unique position that he is in as a challenger to the so-called establishment. But at some point, he will become the story, and so he will become the establishment, and then the attacks on what he actually says will take hold and things will change. Which brings me to the polling. The race for the presidency in the U.S. is not a national election, as I just said. This is a 50-state election, including the territories, but they don't have electoral votes, with 50 different unique situations, with 50 different sets of non-standard election laws pertaining to each state. It starts with primary elections and caucuses in a slew of different states and different times, and turnout for these elections is historically low. So let's start with the primaries and the caucuses. Primaries are political party affairs. They are state, local political party affairs, whether they are open primaries or not. In other words, an open primary, you can go in as a Democrat and vote for Republicans and vice versa. They are held to choose leading candidates by party and apportion delegates to the National Party Convention from each state. If they're a caucus, they're held to send resolutions to the state party. They're held to elect delegates to county conventions, who then elect delegates to state party conventions, who then elect delegates to the national convention. In 2012 and 2010, Montana led the nation with 26% of the population, 26% turning out to vote in a primary election. I was shocked today to learn that it was either in 2010 or 2012, Iowa, that paragon of Democratic virtue, was the lowest, with less than 10% in a primary election. So it must have been 2012. To give you an example of how complicated this can be, people are talking about Donald Trump being a third-party candidate. This is something that comes up a lot these days. The problem with that is it cost Ross Perot millions of dollars in 1992 to establish state party organizations in enough states and in those states where it was required. And I think 6 to 9 states required it to get him on a nationwide ballot. In 26 of those states, he was required by state law to name a vice presidential candidate, which in this case was Admiral Stockdale, if you'll remember, who was, I believe, in the Hanoi Hilton for a while with John McCain, and he's the guy who was famously caught in the headlights like a deer because he froze when he was asked a question. People like to cite Jesse Ventura's successful campaign for governor in Minnesota as an example of how an independent could win a national election in the United States. Keeping in mind, there really is no independent political party in this country. Yes, there's an independence party, but there aren't 50 state independent political parties. You would have to essentially create one. We're talking about Jesse Ventura winning in one state with a unique set of circumstances which predicated his candidacy, and no one was more surprised on election night than Jesse Ventura when he won the position. Doing that 50 times across the country is another story. Let's look at the political voting challenge, the polling challenge. You're looking at 50 states. Whether you have to poll at least 1,000 respondents, where you have to poll at least 1,000 respondents in those states, balanced demographically and geographically from across the state in order to have a reliable poll. And so then you would have to poll state by state. So with 1,000 respondents, and that's a good sample size in a state poll, and actually there are nationwide polls that are 1,000 respondents or 1,500 respondents. So with those, with 1,000 respondents, even in a statewide poll, you're not going to have good demographic breakdowns because the sample sizes are going to be too small for questions with more than a yes-no response in terms of standard deviation, even at the state level, even in a national poll. So what a lot of companies do is they're doing 1,500 and they're asking templated questions, which over the year, those sample sizes will build and they'll have a reliable sample size to be able to say people feel this way or that, and then they can trend the data. You also, as a pollster, have to decide whether you poll using cell phones, landlines, or online. In every state, you have portions of the state where there's no cell phone coverage, or in some cases, they don't have telephones. You have hard-to-reach people, and in almost every state, you have heavily Democratic urban cores, which also are going to have, they're going to skew the results. Then you have to have a series of qualifying questions called a voter screen, which assess whether the respondent is a likely voter. Remember, you know, we're talking about turnout for primaries in the low teens and 20s at best, and you got to try to find those people. And so in a state like Minnesota, if you have 36% turnout, which would be phenomenal for a primary, 4.5 million people, you've got to find the 36% of 100% that are likely to vote in the next election. And you've got to find the 36% of those people in both sides of the political spectrum, or let's just say across the political spectrum, to get the read, and then you have to ask them the right questions, right? Do you say, for example, I'm going to read you a list of candidates. You tell me whether you have a favorable, somewhat unfavorable, or very unfavorable impression of fill in the blank. Or do you ask them to tell you who their favorite candidate is, open-ended? And what's the difference between favorable impression versus favorite versus most popular versus the most familiar name candidate? Right? Those are all different questions. And then and you have to decide which of those questions you're going to ask in a 15-minute poll. And then you poll a series of issue questions, usually aimed at really generating crosstabs on issues. So you can say people who are pro-choice are going to vote for Hillary Clinton, or people who are for a strong foreign policy are going to vote for Scott Walker, let's say, or some Jeb Bush. I don't know. And then you have to ask party affiliation. And again, you have to reassess whether they're likely to vote or participate in a caucus. A lot of these polls are national samples, useless in individual states. A lot of these polls are robocall polls, useless in my view, because you don't really have an interface with a human being. They don't tell us how they ask the questions. Some of these polls are conducted online, and we don't know how people are selected to participate. Are they rigged? You know, I think no. I don't think that they're rigged. I just don't think that they're great tools for the media, but the media loves them because the media likes to show charts and graphs, and it gives talk show hosts something to talk about. And I mentioned templating, meaning that they ask the same questions over and over and over again that don't change from poll to poll that much, and provide tracking data, and you're only hearing this particular poll that was taken this month, and they don't put it in context. The best shot is to look at all the polls and average them, but even that is tricky when you're talking about primary races because you're looking at very low turnout. And it's worthless when you're talking about caucuses because in caucuses, like in Iowa and Minnesota, campaigns can flood the caucus with supporters who can take over the process, which brings me back to a certain degree to radio research. And I got to check my notes here because I think this is really, really key stuff to think about. You can't ask people questions about things they don't know about or which they have never tried, seen, or used. There are tools to assess what might happen and different research methods to assess how individuals might react in future polls to certain things, but there's no way to poll anywhere that you can say with any degree of reliability at all who Republicans or Democrats want as their candidate in 2016. So many things have to take place both behind the scenes politically and in the rest of the world for people to be able to pick a candidate, much less who's going to win the presidential race in 50 states. Could they be right? Could these polls be right? Yeah. Could you go to the casino, and win $50,000 at the slot machine tonight? Yeah, if the purse is $50,000. But I would say that the chances are you probably wouldn't, but you could. And both answers are correct. Yes or no is correct. If any candidate wants to win enough delegates to gain his party's nomination for president, he or she has to build state political organizations that will turn out the vote for he or she on primary night, on caucus night, and on election night, should they win the nomination. If a series of candidates get to the convention without enough delegates to win the nomination on the first ballot, then something called a floor fight, basically floor fight, ensues with all that means in the political world to ensure that one of the candidates ends up being the nominated candidate. And if they're not nominated with enough of a majority, that creates all kinds of problems as well. So that includes rule changes, backroom bargaining, and all the standard political movie stuff. People who want a candidate to win the nomination should get off Facebook, get off Twitter, and get their ass down to the BPOU and start working today, especially if you live in Iowa, in New Hampshire, or Minnesota, or Nevada, or Florida, or Texas. People who want their candidate to run as a third party or independent choice against the mainline parties have an even more Herculean task ahead of them, because they have to build state party organizations from the ground up to ensure their man or woman gets on the ballot in their state. I've made speeches at the Independence Party. I've made speeches. I've talked to people in libertarian groups. We're talking about very, very small groups that wouldn't even be a statewide organization, with the exception of probably the Libertarian Party. So if you intend to have Donald Trump be your candidate, you better get busy. So when you hear discussions of what percentage the vote this or that candidate's going to get, you know, today in the summer of 2015, or who a third party candidate would pull from a year from now, you need to take it with a grain of salt, and commenting on it and thinking about it is probably not worth your time, just as Cecil the Lion is not worth your time. People say, what does Donald Trump mean to the Republican Party? I hear it all the time. And I say, if Republicans want to nominate Trump, let them. You know, if Donald Trump and the country, want to come together, and if we want Donald Trump to be our president, he's certainly qualified. He's an American citizen and is above 35 years of age, right? But we're a long way from that point. We're nowhere near that point. And if you listen to the Black Swan podcast that I did, you're going to hear a number of examples of events which could spin things around in a completely new direction, with an all new playing field for all the candidates on both sides of the political divide and those in the middle. My own personal take on Republicans is that the party is riven with differences. The problem is, historically, people who see things differently in the Republican Party have been able to come together to work for a nominated candidate. But that's not happening anymore. The religious right does not commune with the libertarians, who won't convene with the establishment and moderates. Tea Party people aren't necessarily active in the Republican Party, and they don't indicate that they're going to be. They don't generally contribute much to the Republican process in general. Some people in the Tea Party think it's a political party. Some people in the Tea Party think it should become a political party, but they're a long way from being able to do that because they don't do anything. I've gotten in some trouble because of my assessment of Republicans and the Tea Party people is that they are low information voters. And here's why I say that. I say it because they might know one issue. They might know who Ben Carson is, for example, but they don't know enough about a broad range of issues to be considered high information voters. And many of them are one issue Charlies. They know one thing, like the gold standard. But they don't know anything else about anything else, or they are religious voters, and that's all. What I see with all of these groups, more often than not, is older people who either seem angry or are angry and are frustrated, but more than anything else, they see their world slipping away and they don't know what to do about it. They seem to be looking outside of themselves for a personality to solve the things that they think are problems. Well, we just need to have this guy solve these problems. And of course, there are plenty of people willing to supply the rhetoric and to make this group of angry, frustrated people think that they are the savior that they've been waiting for. And they're loud and they make a lot of noise, but they don't do anything. How on earth do you build an agenda from that kind of place? How do you build an agenda that actually lays out a plan with specifics for reducing the role, power, and cost of government, addresses crises like the entitlement costs going forward, puts forth a reasonable and workable economic plan, addresses foreign policy issues, threats, and lays out a foreign policy that builds on one of the foreign policy schools of thought, so that it dovetails with the defense policy and planning already in the pipeline and addresses real diplomatic issues like, for example, the U.S. and Turkey or the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, the U.S. and Israel, the U.S. and Iran, Europe, the U.K., Latin America, and so on. And this group differs from Democrats because while Democrats have some differences which are showing these days, I think in general they will probably be able to coalesce behind a candidate that becomes a nominee once their convention is over. A commentator the other day wrote that the Democrats could end up with a 1968 convention scenario where the convention fight spilled out into the streets of Chicago when Gene McCarthy's supporters fought with the Hubert Humphrey supporters, and then the whole thing ended up with them fighting against the police because the McCarthy supporters were... I think it was McCarthy were anti-war, and Humphrey didn't want to go that far. He was a moderate Democrat, so forth and so on. And it ended up damaging the Democratic Party's ability to win the 1968 election because they got this ugly bruise going forward from the convention. Well, the fact is that I think it's just as possible that that kind of scenario actually, maybe even more likely, it would be with the Republicans this time around. If the people in the Republican Party don't figure out a way to get people involved in organizing and actually working together to build a workable agenda and plan, people can look at regardless of who the candidate is. If Republicans keep looking to personalities to solve their problems, which I partially think is media-driven these days, I don't think it bodes well for the future of the Republican Party or for winning 2016. Because what you end up with is shards that won't work together, and you end up with nothing reasonable. You end up with the same thing you had in 2012, which is policy all over the road, and none of it seems to make any sense. Tax cuts for the middle class, attacking ISIS, and you know, not talking to Iran, and sending the immigrants back, and all these things that sound good, but when you actually look and try to figure out how you're going to get it done, it becomes a whole different issue. So it remains to be seen, but I will say this. Looking at polls today and predicting an outcome and saying this guy's going to win is really just silly. So once again, thanks to Ryan Plumbing and Heating for sponsoring the Bob Davis Podcast. I got to say, emergency service, residential and business, don't forget Ryan Plumbing and Heating. You know, they have those stickers that people usually stick on their water heater in the basement. So this is like one of those stickers, but it's radio. It's podcasting. It's an audio sticker for your mind to remind you to remember, if you have an emergency, Ryan is great at residential and business emergency service. In St. Paul, 651-224-4771. In Minneapolis, 612-927-6488. They go all over the Minneapolis and St. Paul metro, so it doesn't matter if you're in Plymouth or Hopkins, or if you're in Mendota or White Bear Lake, they are there to cover you for emergency service, residential and business. Ryan Plumbing and Heating, and thanks, Greg, for sponsoring the Bob Davis Podcast. What else do I have? I got to mention for one time here, for sure, I got to thank the digital sponsor of the Bob Davis Podcasts, Madcase Studios. They create original quality automotive artwork, and Mad K will be out at a lot of the antique auto shows this summer. Don't forget, the link at the Bob Davis Podcast page takes you to the Mad K Facebook page, and you can interact with them and find out what they do. They do great stuff. Click on the banners for more information about Mad K, as well as all of the sponsors of the BobDavisPodcast.com. And thank you, if you're listening, for listening on Stitcher.com, iTunes, or TuneIn. I should mention that it would really help if you guys write a review if you're a subscriber on iTunes or if you take the podcast from iTunes. Having reviews always helps, so if you can give me, but only if you're going to give me a positive review. Just write a positive review on there. I don't want to see any negative reviews. So if it's going to be 3 or 4 stars, I guess it's okay. But if it's 2, don't bother. Of course, I don't know why you'd be listening. And also, if you are listening, you know, any device, you can listen off the page at the BobDavisPodcast.com. It always helps to subscribe because the podcast is downloaded through iTunes or Stitcher or TuneIn directly to your phone, and then it plays through the phone from the phone's memory rather than actually streaming it from the website, but you can do that if you want. And thanks for liking, sharing, and favoriting and following on Facebook and Twitter. I'm bdavis7843 on Instagram, and Instagram is surpassing Twitter because Instagram is so cool. So thank you guys for, I guess, watching me on Instagram as well, and thanks for your donations for the Mobile Podcast Command Unit at thebobdavispodcast.com. The next trip is going to be out to Sturgis, and that is coming up the first week of August. We are heading out to Sturgis to cover another one of these great summer events, and that's going to be the next big thing for the Mobile Podcast Command Unit, and I really appreciate the donations, whether it is $5, $10, whatever you want to donate. I really appreciate those, and those are really crowdfunding the Mobile Podcast Command Unit. So if you like those podcasts, feel free to make a donation. So that's pretty much it. Thanks for listening to Podcast 397. Don't take those polls so much to heart, because everything is going to change. I'm going to sit here on the deck and drink my coffee and enjoy my tiki torches.
Just